Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Folks, Guy Williams typically with us on Monday. We were off yesterday, so he joins us today, President of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and we thank him for same. Guy, welcome to the show. Guy?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Said welcome to
Say good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Guy, last week, tough week. Retail sales report comes out, inflation numbers up, jobs report not as rosy as they thought it might be. When we look at all of this together, we synthesize this. What does this mean to average Joe?
Well, a couple of things. One is there is a chance that we could come back to the worst features of the Jimmy Carter era, which is slow growth and high inflation. I don't expect that, but that's sort of a worst case scenario. But what is happening is costs are going up faster than wages. So the average person is actually losing spending power. And it really emphasizes the importance of looking at how you control your spending, what you're spending money on, and adjusting your budget based upon expectations for the future. But it's going to be a tough time. Real estate is going to be affected next year for a couple of reasons. One is that the mortgage rate will be higher. So for people who are buying based upon a payment, which is almost all of us when we buy our first or second house, you'll have to buy a smaller house or a less desirable neighborhood, while simultaneously real estate prices are going up because construction costs haven't slowed down yet. So it's really a tough time to be buying a house. The other thing is inventory is smaller, because builders can't build houses as quickly as they used to because of supply chain issues. So big effect in the real estate area, a lesser effect in the pocketbook in terms of what you can buy, and potentially a slowing economy, which is very concerning.
When we look at, and we have this argument and this debate about this all the time, I know the Wall Street Journal had an article this morning about it, but I've read a series of articles over the last 3 weeks about money supply. The differences when we look historically as to how we dealt with inflationary pressures, what we did, tight money controls and so forth. If you could, just a short primer for the benefit of our listening audience as to what that debate is all about.
Yeah, Milton Friedman is a famed economist, and he said inflation is in always and every ways about the money supply. The Keynesian theory is it's not really about the money supply, it's about aggregate demand. And I'm going to simplify that away from the economist. What people say is if there's too much money in the economy, the supply chain just can't produce more goods. And so you're just stuck. And I think a simple example is imagine a group of cowboys going into town on Friday night, and they have their paycheck, and the town has a limited supply of beer, which they usually run out of, and they have a limited supply of new clothing and hotel rooms, well, somebody gives the Cowboys twice as much money. Well, when they arrive in town, they can't drink more beer. They want to, but there's just not more beer there. So the bartender raises the price. Same thing. They all want a bath. They all want a new shirt. There aren't enough new shirts, so the retailers raise the price to balance the money supply. And that's the simple analogy of too much money chasing too few goods. The counter argument is the supply chain will always increase to match demand. And that used to be true before the pandemic, but in those days, we had a very seamless supply chain where you could design something, make it in China, and 6 weeks later, have a brand new product here in the U.S. The supply chain is beginning to break down a bit and is certainly strained. So it's pushing prices all the way across. The other complicating thing is the Green New Deal, whether you're for or against it, will raise oil and gas prices. And proponents have said that's a good thing because it will reduce demand. Opponents say it's a tough thing because there isn't really a transition to alternatives yet. But both sides agree that that will raise the cost of energy, at least in the short run. So all those things push inflation up.
And the operative word there is transition, right? Whether either model that you believe in, the same thing relative to this green energy development that we're looking at. Do you get the impression that folks are just not focusing enough or are unwilling to focus on this transition? Because it seems to be an all or nothing proposition, that all of these are mutually exclusive approaches. It's either one or the other. Am I off base there?
No, and unfortunately, it's become way too politicized because if we want to transition away from fossil fuels, it's entirely possible, but it's not going to happen overnight. And we have to understand that it's going to happen at different rates in different countries. I've always thought that the simplest solution would be a carbon tax on everything, imports, exports, consumption, and then you just let the market solve it, whether it's hydropower, solar power, wind power. It will begin to adjust, and then imports will have to be taxed based on their carbon density, and you'd get to the right solution. The challenge we have right now is China is saying they're totally on board, but they're increasing their density and their carbon use faster than the rest of the world is decreasing. So we're not actually making any progress. We're losing ground. And then when India kicks in right behind China and Indonesia right behind India, we're actually going to lose ground for decades despite all the promises. So we've sort of adopted an approach of a lot of pain in the rich world, no net reduction, in fact, a net increase, because we're pursuing it in a difficult way. So there's room for improvement, but it's going to be hard to get there because it's hard to get both sides to talk to each other.
So, but doesn't that lead to, in this transition period, I mean, this transition period could be how long, Guy? I mean, I'm thinking 15, 20 years.
Think about how long it took to transition to natural gas from coal. I mean, to transition away from wood to coal. You know, all the transitions take decades. This is not an overnight thing. And once again, foreign countries, particularly the big ones like India, Indonesia, and China, have a tougher way to go and less resources. One thing that we tend to forget because China gets all the press, China is not as rich as the United States. They've actually stopped growing. Their working age population is starting to shrink. Their GDP grew really a little bit less than ours last year. Well, if they grow less than we do, we're on a much bigger base. So we're actually accelerating away from them. They have limited ability to achieve what they want to achieve if they're telling the truth, if they really want to become carbon neutral. And it's hard to tell if they're really sincere. So this is going to be a longer term transition, and it's not being managed particularly well right now.
So when we think about a 15, 20 year transition period and these forces, you know, of this mutually exclusive approach, does this mean that we have 15 years of just instability? I mean, because, you know, gas prices could be up, they could be down, depending on whether OPEC wants to engage, not engage, whether they're going to actually act like a consortium or not. I mean, you know, it's it just seems to me that we're kind of setting ourselves up for a very volatile couple of decades.
We are, and I think we've irrationally ignored some things like nuclear power that make a whole lot of sense that would make this transition considerably easier. One of the challenges with OPEC is they really can't produce as much oil as we think they can. So their ability to fill the gap is not as robust as it used to be. And, you know, if you remember, we released oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve with the objective of reducing oil and gas prices. There was a very short blip down, and now prices are back up.
Yeah, that didn't work so well.
No, it couldn't have worked. I mean, that was designed for a crisis. Okay, shipping breaks down for a month for some reason. You know, Iran blocks the Straits of Hormuz, and you use Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But using it for pricing is just not going to be effective.
So, I mean, so if you look into your crystal ball, this instability reveals itself in how many, you know, ways? I mean, you know, when we think about the average Joe, what does he face for the next 10 to 20 years? I mean, I have this insatiable curiosity and trying to visualize this, because it just doesn't make any sense that, you know, it's this all or nothing game that we're playing right now.
Well, the good thing is, first, America's a democracy, and the average person can see through a lot of the foolishness, and they're only willing to put up with a certain amount of cost without a gain. And so consumers are going to look at their energy prices going up. In California, they're going to look at not being able to install natural gas if they want it. Same thing in parts of New York. And they're going to eventually tell the politicians, folks, we're in New York City. We're right next door to Pennsylvania shale oil fields. Let's just pump some natural gas here and cut our prices by 50%. So eventually the consumer says, no, enough is enough. This is not helpful. And what you're doing is not actually going to lower global temperatures. It's going to make my life worse, but it won't actually help. And I think when you get to things that don't actually help, that cost the consumer money, they vote their pocketbook. And never forget our own Louisiana James Carville telling Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. Because Clinton kept asking Carville, what issues, what issues, what issues? And Carville finally just cut it down and said, Bill, it's the economy, stupid. And that was what they focused on. And it is the economy. If the average consumer sees their prices going up, doesn't feel like it's, you know, we're not actually fighting a war. We're not trying to defeat the Nazis. It's a more amorphous, difficult to measure challenge. And then we realize that our sacrifice doesn't matter because China, India, and Indonesia are making the atmosphere worse. Then people say, well, why am I doing this? We need a different plan.
And you add to that this move of, you know, kind of social justice, this redistribution of wealth and everything else that goes along with that. And part of that, this mantra of not rewarding risk takers. And when you think about corporate America and a lot of the that they actually take, and, you know, you study this for a living, a lot of these ventures, far more of these ventures fail than succeed, right? That's still the case?
Oh, yeah. Entrepreneurs are pretty courageous, and it doesn't matter what group they come from. It's very tough to start a new business, and more than half of them don't make it. And I applaud people that do that. It's one of our favorite things to do at work is to help people start new businesses. And that really is the route to wealth. I think we also, ignore at our peril the fact that America does give people an opportunity, and the internet is absolutely colorblind. If you come up with an idea, you propose it, you sell it on Etsy or eBay, no one knows if the founder of the company is man, woman, you know, mixed, who knows what. You're whatever you want to be on the internet. So we've created an absolute blank slate where people can succeed. And I think we need to celebrate that and encourage entrepreneurship, recognize achievement, and say, look, this is the way out. One of the interesting side effects of COVID is new business startups have increased. They were trending down before COVID. They're actually trending back up. So I'm optimistic that we're going to have a lot of good entrepreneurship from lots of people. And it really doesn't matter what ethnic group they're from. They succeed now.
Isn't it amazing that ingenuity knows no race, no class, no economic strata?
Yeah, you know? I mean, you know, if you study New Orleans history, most of the architecture and most of the buildings were built by the Creole craftsmen. I mean, it's just individual desire and, you know, people wanting to do something well, wanting to create something better. And we're still a good country for that. And we're still seeing a lot of people start new businesses. And we've certainly in the areas of mortgage lending eliminated anything except, look, it's just about credit score and down payment. You know, That's all that matters.
And the barrier is the same for most of everyone as well. All right, got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'd love to hear from you, 504-260-1870. We will be right back after the break, folks. Stay with us.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We're back. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, I have a text here, kind of interesting. It says, the problem with capitalism is it tends to cannibalize itself. Do you see it that way?
I understand what they're trying to say, which is if you're doing very, very well, someone will come in and compete with you. But we've tried lots of different economic systems, and this one is by far the best. I mean, anyone who's tried the socialist system or the communist system and come here will tell you this really works better. So I'd have to say I understand the criticism, but I'd have to reject it, that it's such a strong negative that you should go a different direction.
Let's pivot, if you don't mind. We've talked about this a couple of times. I get a lot of text about it. This whole notion of cryptocurrency, I think you have some strong feelings about it. And now NFTs, these non-fungible tokens. I started reading some about this last night. Again, I still don't understand it. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I mean, my law enforcement background leads me to believe that it's a Ponzi scheme, but I don't want to go there. I mean, that's what I feel. It just doesn't feel right. Well, I don't know.
Well, we'll start with the crypto. Crypto was invented by a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto. And the challenge is we to this day don't know if he's an individual, a man, a woman, or a group. So invented by someone that is, who knows? Second, when he invented cryptocurrency, he posted London Times, and the article was about bank bailouts, about hyperinflation, about the money supply. And some of his statements on the internet at the time indicated that he had no faith in the value of currency. So he wanted something that was inflation proof. He also didn't trust governments, so he wanted something that could be transacted without a Federal Reserve or Bank of England in the middle, and you could move it around the world quickly without an intermediary. The benefit to that is certainly you can move it around the world immediately if you have a Bitcoin account or an Ethereum account. You can do it anonymously. And so you're not subject to a federal authority. But back to your law enforcement, that also means if you're a criminal, it's easy to hide. And all of the ransom is paid in Bitcoin. The other problem is U.S. dollars have an intrinsic value because you have to pay federal fees and taxes in U.S. dollars, and it is the recognized currency of the U.S. So it will always have worth. Bitcoin could go to zero. There have been a number of coins invented that had a flash in the pan and were valuable for a while and then went to zero. The one that's most intriguing is Dogecoin or Doggycoin, which was invented as a joke, had a big surge, a big drop, and then Elon Musk said, I'm going to start letting you buy Teslas with Dogecoin or Doggycoin, and now it's going back up. But it could just as easily go to zero. So a lot of challenges to Bitcoin. The criminality is a big issue. Ransomware, illegal things are paid in that. Some people see it as an inflation hedge, and it could be, but it's only a hedge as long as someone else is willing to buy it. And that's the danger, because it has no inherent value.
Looking into your crystal ball, how does this end up? I mean, I just, when you're running an operation that has no regulatory oversight, no real controls, there's got to be somebody out there figuring out how to cannibalize all of this. Is it just a matter of time? I mean, the beauty of the monetary system in the U.S., you will have these one-offs of cannibalization, but that's it. Not of the whole damn system.
Yeah, it's interesting because China abolished bitcoins. They said you can't do mining, which used to be the second biggest miner of bitcoins in the whole world. You can't do any transactions in Bitcoin, and if you're a Chinese citizen, you can't own Bitcoin. And the reason they did that is they did not like the anonymous ability to move money. You know, if you're in China and you become out of favor, they want to be able to make sure they can take your money as well and control your financial assets. So they really don't like the anonymous aspect. So I think totalitarian governments are definitely opposed. Russia is not so deeply opposed because a lot of the ransomware flows to Russia. Indonesia declared that Bitcoin is un-Islamic, so you can't do it there. So it's hard to see what the future holds, although there are what are called stable coins, where in theory, the bank that originates it or the first person actually has assets that equal the value of the coin, and then you're able to transact it around the world with the same speed. Now, the challenge is you've got to believe that whoever the originator was actually is going to do it. Now, there's some talk about the Federal Reserve creating a digital currency, and that could easily happen. Chinese bank has done that. The Central Bank of China has created a digital currency. So I would say it's fairly likely that we'll have some form of digital currency probably within the next 5 to 10 years in the United States.
But that defeats all of the reasons why they develop the cryptocurrency in the first place, right? I mean, because it's going to be regulated. It's not going to be anonymous. It's, you know,
it's also not going to be inflation proof, which was Nakamoto's fear. Is he was really afraid of inflation, and he thought that the government would ultimately inflate their way out of the debt crisis. So no, a stable coin does not solve any of those problems unless it's indexed to something like gold or a hard commodity.
So is there a risk, because I've read stories of difficulties that folks were having of converting some of these cryptocurrencies back into cash?
Oh, there's absolutely a risk. There, literally hundreds of, not hundreds, thousands of these currencies exist, and they start out with very little value, you know, 0.000, and then skyrocket up 1,000%. And what's one of the things that happens is unscrupulous people will invent a new coin. And the best example was a squid coin based on the Squid Game. And they used all the graphics and the pictures from the Korean Netflix series. Once the value went up to a certain level and people had bought these squid coins, the developers disappeared with the money. And there was no getting any money back because it wasn't regulated anywhere. They didn't know what country the developers were in. And that's the British have a phrase for that. They call it a rug pull, which is you're standing on the rug and somebody pulls the rug out from under you. Well, it was a perfect rug pull, went up and went down to zero, and the money just disappeared. So there is absolutely a danger with some of these currencies that it could disappear or that nobody will want to buy from you, and then you're stuck. You know, you own it, and you remember Beanie Babies when you could look at the catalog values, it's worth X. But then when you tried to sell it, it's like, well, there's nobody willing to pay that price. I mean, I see the catalog price, and I see that it's supposedly very valuable, but nobody is paying that price. And if no one will pay it, then you're stuck.
I remember going through the attic looking for our Beanie Babies.
It's
I was
fun
one of
now
those fools that thought I could actually transfer it into, you know, convert it into cash.
Yeah, and you know, it is unfortunate because people got hooked into that. But I mean, it was just a stuffed toy. Now you go to garage sales, it's like take one with any sale. You know, here's a bag of Beanie Babies, or you know, go on a Mardi Gras float and throw them.
Yeah. All right, let's get to a break. When we come back, if you could try to drill this hard head of mine about NFTs and what this is about and what's the basis of the value of this item, if any. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us, folks.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, 3-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, at the beginning of 2021, very few people have heard about non-fungible tokens, otherwise called NFTs. By the end of the year, they had become popular enough that the Collins Dictionary said that NFTs was the word of the year for 2021. JP Morgan analysts say that monthly sales of digital tokens hovers around $2 billion a month. Guy, what is this? I can't figure it out. I'm not sure what it is.
You're not the only one, because an NFT really is an unusual thing. It's a digital asset that represents a real-world object. So imagine for a moment LeBron James does a great basketball play, super dunk, and the NBA sells you an NFT of that dunk. So now you own that image of that super dunk. Now, anybody else can go on the NBA website and see it, but you own it. Now, you cannot put it on a T-shirt and sell it, because the NBA retains the right to sell T-shirts with their logo merchandise. But you can sell your ownership of that signature dunk to somebody else if they're willing to buy it. But nonetheless, everyone that wants to see it can see it. You just are the owner. And there's been a tremendous demand. The most outrageous example is an artist called Winkleman, better known as Beeple. And he does drawings, and he posts them on the web. And he took his first 5,000 drawings, and they'd been done over a period of about 6 or 8 years, put them into one big composite collage, and sold it, called Everydays, for $69 million. Now, the incredible thing about that is you or I can go online and look at any one of those drawings or all of those drawings for free. The person who owns the composite, all 5,000, owns the composite. It doesn't mean he can make prints and sell prints. The artist retained the right to sell prints, but he owns that digital token. And if you're wondering, what the heck does he really own? Well, it's registered. It's only his. Only he can own it. But it gets worse. In the metaverse, Snoop Dogg is really a pretty creative guy. He's selling lots near his house, so you can build next to his house in the imaginary world. And these are selling for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you're buying an imaginary lot in an imaginary world so you can build next to Snoop Dogg. But it's not like he bought a house in Lakeview and you bought a house in the same neighborhood where you can go knock on the door and say, hey, you know, you have a cup of coffee or you want to come over and play with the kids. It's a whole imaginary world, but this has exploded and people are buying art images, sports images, sneaker images. A particularly fun one, the Charmin people sold an NFT of toilet paper, and people bought it. It's an intriguing world.
Is it that easy to take money from people? I mean, what is the intrinsic value? If you can't do anything with it, it's just that you have something that maybe some other person in the world has a desire for?
It's the scarcity value. You know, somebody bought a yacht, and it was a drawing of a yacht that could have been done by a 12-year-old. It just wasn't very attractive. But once again, in the metaverse, almost $500,000. And I'm thinking, you know, you can't even take that out on like Pontchartrain. Now, granted, you don't have to pay for a slip, but so you own an imaginary yacht that doesn't even look very attractive. But the fact that you own it, Jack Dorsey sold his first tweet for $2.9 million. Now, I don't even know what the tweet was. You know, hi, I'm Jack Dorsey. This is Twitter. But so what? I mean, what are you going to do with it? But people are buying them. It is very, very popular. It's interesting world.
So we actually have banking operations that are now, you know, across this world, getting into this NFT business. So I can put this as a statement of worth. I mean,
you can, because you have exclusive ownership rights, and as long as somebody else is willing to buy it, you know, it's valuable. Now, the challenge is, you know, a lot of artists are getting into this, and certainly I would, but what is somebody going to really pay for it? I mean, Charmin had their NFTP, non-fungible toilet paper. Who really, I mean, is somebody really going to buy that from you? Maybe.
So I list this on my assets, and I give you this list, and it's got all of these NFTs there. You're a banker. What do you do with that? And what do the regulatory folks say? Hey, you know, guy, you made this loan to Newell, and we see all of this. We don't understand what it is. Where do we go from here? You're paying real money for this. So it's not, you know, you're getting an imaginary product, but you're paying real dollars, right?
Yeah, you're paying incredible real dollars. There was an NFT
So what do they tell you, Guy Williams, when the regulators come in and they said, you know, you made this loan and he's got all these assets listed as collateral for this. I mean, where are we going in the real world?
Well, the regulators would say these are so volatile that you need to discount them by, you know, 90-95%, because you better make sure that he has other assets and the ability to repay if they go to zero. Because think about it for a minute. There was an NFT of a cat with a Pop-Tart body that sold for $600,000. It's called Nyan Cat. Now, is somebody else going to be willing to pay that? Maybe, but if they're ever not, you're going to look at that thing and say, what the heck was I thinking? I mean, I paid real money, and I own this digital representation of a cat that looks like it has a Pop-Tart for a body. It's an unusual thing. I think that when you attach the NFT to something valuable, such as the ability to remark it.
So, what about real estate? Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a possibility, right?
Yeah, well,
a percentage of ownership in a piece of real estate? I don't know.
Well, that's getting back to the blockchain, which does make sense. If you use blockchain to record real estate transactions, it can't be altered. It becomes a permanent record. And if it's a record of real ownership of a tangible asset, that makes sense.
Right.
Intangible assets like copyrights will have value and could be sold as NFTs, but in my mind, you have to be able to do something other than just sell it to the next bigger fool. You have to have some ability to merchandise it, to be able to market it. The Economist magazine did an article on NFTs, and their cover was about cryptocurrency and NFTs. And so they said, well, we're going to sell an NFT of the cover. And they sold it. It was about 230,000 euros. Now, it didn't give you the ability to reproduce those covers, not that you'd really want to. It didn't give you the ability to market them. It just meant you owned the digital representation. Well, at that time, you could have gone to a newsstand and gotten a new Economist with that cover on it. You could look it up on the internet and see the cover, but somebody owns that cover. Is that going to be valuable? I sort of doubt it. Now, once again, getting back to the LeBron dunk, if you can market that and you can use it in commercials, you can put it on T-shirts, then I think maybe you have some value. And I think that's going to be the direction artists are going to go. Yeah, I'm going to sell you this. You'll own it. Every time you transfer it to someone else, I get 10% of the proceeds. But you can make images. You can do silk screens. You can do whatever.
Well,
but
Guy,
just owning a digital makes a mess.
I'm disappointed because this is all clear as mud to me still.
So you didn't buy a lot next to Snoop Dogg in the metaverse?
No, and I'm not going to. If I can't touch it, feel it, massage it, I want to be able to touch something. I don't get this. I guess if you're day trading NFTs and you're getting in and you're getting out, and you can make money real quick that way, more power to you. But if you're in it for the long haul, I just don't see any future here at all.
Yeah, I think I would stay clear of that.
Yeah, that's just me. As always, thank you so much for your time and your insight. We really appreciate it. That hour flew by.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
All right, folks. We'll be right back. Scoot's up next. He joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, you know, yesterday there was a lot of reaction to something that I called the young people who are carjacking cars. And most people, just overwhelmingly, I was supported in what I called them. There were a few people who disagreed. So we're going to talk about that. And I got a lot of reaction to yesterday's show about carjackings, and we'll get into all of that. Also, we will talk about whether or not the names of the men who were involved with Jeffrey Epstein, whether some of those names should be released. Apparently, it's going to be up to a judge. But their attorneys are arguing they have a right to privacy.
I don't know about that. That's going to be interesting.
Yep.
Scoot's up next, folks. Stay tuned. We'll see you again tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.